I don't see an indicator that doesn't indicate that we're not headed for 70s style stagflation, but also that we don't even have the neoliberal way out of it.
Derek Barn, you're back.
I'm back.
The essay we're going to be discussing today is Lukács's Reification and the Consciousness of the Proletariat. It's an excerpt from History and Class Consciousness. And I just now, like 10 minutes ago, not less than that, finished reading it. Like I read it, I sat down and read it all, and now I'm going to talk about it. So hold my hand, be gentle with me, walk me through this text. Let me see, before I let you summarize it, let me see if I can summarize it. This is Lukács' attempt to explain how it is that bourgeois reason can no longer address or, can no longer aim itself at its own conditions of possibility, that it, that the commodity form has reified not only our productive relations, but our consciousness. And what this means is that all manner of ideological apparatuses, to use Althusserian talk, which we probably ought to avoid, are reified. And that the consequence of that reification is that we've lost our capacity within bourgeois society to really engage in critical reasoning or to be able to develop an understanding that has a justification or a foundation, that instead we only develop formal systems of understanding.
Right.
That's my quick and dirty summary. Is that correct? And how would you add to that?
I would say that Lukács takes a commodity fetish form and goes back into Hegel and Fichte with it. And then back into Kant, seeing bourgeois philosophy as becoming purely analytic, like you said, because of the frustration and contradiction of society as object and individual as subject. That leads to the inability of bourgeois reason to actually understand itself and turn itself into a process, that is enacted, instead it constantly flits back and forth between an individual who is subject to history and subject of history, and the object, which is literally everything else. And the leap that Lukács is asking you to make, and it's a leap that I am much more sympathetic with than the leap that he asked you to make in like the methodology in Marx article for the end of the same text that we both kind of went off on many years ago, is that alienation through reification like affects all bourgeois thinking and everybody in it, not just the capitalist. But if there is a way out of that problem, it is through the subject object of the proletariat. Right. And for most people, when I say this, this is going to sound like, well, how do you jump from the commodity fetish all the way to like the inability to deal with? For example, he talks about the analytic problem of both in itself and for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And how that seems to be constantly split in bourgeois thinking, but also like is and ought are constantly split. Self and other are constantly split, and these antinomies are actually a reflection of the way that he thinks that the stages of commodity production actually structure the way we talk about and think about things to the point that it really limits our ability to do like meaningful philosophy or think our as part of this project, actually, why the bourgeois, historical mission can't be achieved by the bourgeois themselves. Like that's part of what this is trying to explain. It's trying to go in and like, well, it messes with bourgeois consciousness. It meshes with all consciousness in capitalist society, but it also limits bourgeois philosophy. It makes it posits these analytic categories that you can never bridge, but also never completely truly define. And, basically if you were going to accuse Lukács of anything here, this is like his lapsarianism of capitalism and the way it even affects the mind. And the reason why I think this is important, you kind of brought up one reason. Althusserianism is an attempt to get rid of this. Part of what Althusserianism is aimed at is to get out of the implications of reification theory. It's aimed at other things too, but that's the big one. Because Althusser sees this as unscientific. This is not a scientific way of thinking, and he's going to make Marx scientific. The other thing is you can't understand critical theory without understanding this. Like whether or not, no matter how you feel about Habermas and Adorno and Geuss and Horkheimer and Marcuse, etc., if you don't understand this essay, you don't really understand their operation points. Like, you don't understand where they're coming from. They take this much farther than Lukács does. I mean, they take it to the point where it seems like there's no way out of it. Honestly, that's kind of why Lukács accuses them of being on a hotel grand abyss, but they're picking this up. Like, this is what they're running with. And I also think that this essay is so important to later Marxism that I actually think it's hard to read Marx now without me having this essay in my head, even though I had read Marx before I read this. But now when I was reading this, I realized like my understanding of reification actually came from Lukács before I even knew that it came from Lukács. Because I was always trying to figure out, okay, what's the distinction between reification and Marxism versus like reification or what we sometimes call hypostatization and like analytic philosophy, what's the difference? And the difference is located in this essay. Now we can talk about whether or not it's actually Marxian, or Marxist proper. But I do think it's really important to understand this, even if you come from one of these Marxist schools that rejects it, because you probably don't completely understand what and why you're rejecting this.
Mm-hmm. Right. While I was reading it, there were a couple of points where I had some slight objections, but maybe we can go through those in a minute. But one of the things that I want to point out is that you said that he doesn't believe that the bourgeoisie can complete their revolution. I'm paraphrasing what you said, or can overcome the reification.
Right.
And what he actually says, at least in translation here, is that a radical change in outlook is not feasible on the soil of bourgeois society.
Right. Well,
which is a bit stronger than merely saying that the bourgeoisie as a class will not be able to achieve it. Or at least I read it that way, because it is not so much that that just the capitalist class or the owning class alone are incapable of overcoming reification, but that every ideology, scientific endeavors to economics to law, none of these are capable of taking up their own conditions of possibility into their analysis. And when you say their own conditions of possibility, what you're talking about is the political, economic, relations that create and produce conditions in the world. And that is, for Lukács, the material or ontological or substantial foundation for society. And that substantial foundation, as I understand it in this essay, is demonstrates that it is reified.
Yeah.
That the fetish character of the commodity makes our material foundations reified. Now, we should talk about, just for a moment, what that word reification means, because we can throw it around and a lot of people, including me, will lose track of what it means. I think of reification as when you take, in a way, you could say that Lukács is his own reification theory reifies the social relations, because it's when you take these social relations to be natural, substantial, material, rather than a product of human consciousness or history. That's what reification is when you take a transhistorical view of what should be treated as historical phenomenon. It's when you take a natural view of things that are produced through culture or artificially. You could reify heterosexuality by ignoring the history of the development of the concept of heterosexuality and thinking that that is just a natural condition for humanity through all time. That's a reification of the idea. So, but that doesn't seem to be quite what Lukács is saying. It's close to, but not quite what he's saying when he talks about reification, because he does think that it is historically a historical condition that we're in, that the substance of our life, or the material foundation of our life, or even the principles, the starting principles of our ideas or ideological constructs, like, for instance, the foundations of laws, all of those are now split off from the formal systems of thought or our material everyday lived experience, or and so on. So, but anyway, am I explaining what reification is well?
Yeah, I think so. I like to turn on my like basic bitch philosopher hat on and just go through the word. I mean, the word in German is Verdinglichtung, which means literally making into a thing. It's related to the analytic concept of reification, which also is an anglicized version of a Latin word meaning res, thing, farfere, to make. So it's to make into a thing. It's like, so to call, this is actually a literal translation. We just have to use a little bit of Latin to make it work. And that concept is actually predates translations of Marx into English as to where it shows up, which is kind of confusing. So the first place the reification shows up in English philosophy is actually Alfred North Whitehead. And that's when he calls it reification, or the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, which is based off of, like, it's actually derived from like a theological error called hypostaticization, which is to give an element of God concrete reality. All this is very confusing, but it basically means to say like love is real or unreal is to pretend it is like a object in the universe, which it is not, right? So that is a reification. In Marxism, it's related, but it's a little different. So way back in the day when we both worked for Zero Books, I did a series on alienation, and reification was a subset of alienation.
Mm-hmm.
So alienation just means estrangement from anything. I mean, it's just human estrangement in general, to make alien, to make unlike yourself. Reification is a specific form of alienation where you make something like a relationship into a thing. So you treat it as a thing, thus making it seem like it's an object when it's more like a process or something like that. Commodity fetishism and capital is a specific form of reification. Now, alienation is a concept that Althusserians want to throw away because they don't see it as scientific. So in doing so, they have to kind of get rid of reification too, but they want to keep the commodity fetishism elements of capital. And so they, what they do is they find Marx's talk of ideology to do that. But pretty clearly in Marx proper, and this is not just in Lukács's version of Marx, alienation is the condition of general estrangement. We talk about the four forms of economic alienation, which is the basis of bourgeois society. Alienation from your labor, alienation from worker to from work for the worker process, alienation, which, you know, which is specialization. Both of these come up in Lukács. Alienation from worker from society, and then alienation from worker, and this is all in early Marx. And then the commodity fetish is basically using a commodity to stand in for all the relationships that go into the production of society. So you use like the products of society as a stand-in and exchange for the processes and social relationships that make society. What I find interesting in, you know, my schema there, you have alienation, you have reification, you have commodity fetish as a specific form of reification. What is interesting in Lukács, if Lukács takes the commodity fetish first, because it's, you know, the most important thing, and then basically he goes from that back out into reification, and then kind of into alienation itself. Like what he's talking about as the philosophical problem of alienation in bourgeois philosophy is actually for him coming from the way the commodity fetish has like stamped a way to think on our brain, because it leads, the way we produce things leads to a certain increasing, you know, like we don't see the, what does he call it? The irrational content versus the rational subject. And by irrational here, he doesn't mean like,
the irrational content might be thought of as in strictly economic terms, the use values that are produced in society.
Right.
And the rational content would be the quantitative exchange values that are produced in society.
Right.
And what makes them rational is the fact that they can be, you know, quantitative. And so that form of reason for Lukács is a different category than mere rationality, or instrumental rationality, where you think in terms of these quantified relations. Reason would have to take up the conditions of possibility for these quantitative relations to arise.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is why there is this. So there's something else going on in the background here. So Lukács is trying to like tie in the Max Weber critique of bourgeois instrumental reason and say like, look, we've had to move away from what we might call Aristotelian or teleological reasoning, which is, you know, the purpose is part of what you're moving towards, to like purely instrumental and quantitative reasoning, which is increasingly reducing everything to math. And the reason why we do that is it makes it seem more controllable, but it's also like how we measure and are able to produce stuff and produce growth in bourgeois society. And I mean, what Lukács is saying, because you're right to point out that maybe I was too light and just blaming the bourgeoisie, right? Because what Lukács is saying is, like, all elements of bourgeois society and all people involved in it, as long as they are involved in bourgeois society and don't see themselves as completely needing to break from it, are ultimately going to replicate this mistaken thinking. And it's not because, like, math didn't exist in pre-bourgeois society, or even commodities didn't exist in pre-bourgeois society. It's that they were incidental. There was trade.
That was one form of life amongst many.
Right.
The commodity exchange was one way to meet needs amongst many, and not the dominant one, not the universal one. And we could go through this essay and then think about the history of the formation of capitalism, and even look at the current world situation, and question on empirical grounds to the degree to which the commodity form is completely totalizing, right?
Right.
But let's just take it for granted that it is totalizing, as Lukács argues in this essay, because I think it is. I think it's pretty totalizing. The question, I guess, that arises is, there's two questions. One is, which is the degree to which the fetish nature of the commodity creates conditions wherein our own thinking no longer is not only capable of, but pushed to consider the conditions of our own possibility, or the grounds of our life, or to reach beyond mere instrumental reason. I'm going to be flat-footed here. For me, one of the things that came to mind, and it always comes to mind, it's like a habit that I'm actually trying to break at this point, even though I think it is useful, is the fact of the tendency for the rate of profit to decline, producing crises within capitalism, even within its own rationality, which might tend to push at least the workers or the people, and that would include people who are, let's say, part of the reserve army of proletariat, who, like, rely on the state to survive, to go beyond merely thinking about things in terms of instrumental reason. I just want to bring this up. You can toss this aside if I'm not making sense or if I'm misunderstanding, but there's a section here where he talks about Hilferding.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, the consequence, I'm just going to read this, and I'm not sure if this is going to be what I want to say, but this consequence follows with such inevitability that Tugin Barnofsky, for example, attempts in this series to draw the necessary conclusions from a century of crises by excluding consumption from economics entirely and founding a pure economics based only on production. The source of crises, whose existence cannot be denied, is then found to lie in incongruities between the various elements of production, i.e. in purely quantitative factors. Hilferding puts his finger on the fallacy underlying all such explanations. They operate only with economic concepts such as capital, profit, accumulation, etc., and believe that they possess the solution to the problem when they have discovered the quantitative relations on the basis of which either simple or expanded reproduction is possible, or else there are disturbances. They overlook the fact that there are qualitative conditions attached to these quantitative relations, that it is not merely a question of units of value, which can easily be compared with each other, but also use values of a definite kind, which must fulfill a definite function in production and consumption. Further, they are oblivious of the fact that in the analysis of the process of reproduction, more is involved than just aspects of capital in general, so that it is not enough to say that an excess or a deficit of industrial capital can be balanced by an appropriate amount of money capital, nor is it a matter of fixing or circulating capital nor is it a matter of fixed or circulating capital, but rather of machines, raw materials, labor power of a quite definite sort if disruptions are to be avoided. Now, and then he goes on and he quotes Marx, where Marx talks about how the cycle of capital value can be, from the bourgeois capitalist point of view, completed even if the commodities produced aren't put back into production. So, you know, if you produce yarn, you sell the yarn, it doesn't matter to you whether or not that yarn is knitted into sweaters. You now have money capital with which you can reinvest in the production of yarn. And all I could think of here is that that would only hold true for the yarn producing capitalists, to the extent that there would still be a market for the yarn down the road in a society where sweaters are no longer being produced. That eventually, even though he may have sold his yarn once, that doesn't mean if the capitalist who buys the yarn isn't able to make use of it productively and produce a profit down the road, the yarn producer will also be affected by that purely quantitative relationship in the market. There are disruptions within the capitalism as a quantitative system that arise from its quantitative dimension, that can't be solved by changing the qualitative side, by innovation in the realm of technology or creating more conditions of, more safe. Sometimes they might be, but ultimately, theoretically anyway, they can't be overcome. The quantitative difficulties that emerge, the tendency for the rate of profit to decline, won't be overcome by technological advances or safety measures or finding
turning them into rents, for example.
Right, or turning them into rents or finding new products which meet new needs or any of those kinds of irrational sides.
Planned obsolescence.
Rents is still quantitative, but like the qualitative side, like technological, even that might be still quantitative, but like finding new markets, finding new commodities, finding new needs and new consumers. None of that is going to ultimately solve this problem of the tendency of the rate of profit to decline, it seems to me. So it seems like the quantitative realm is a source of contradictions and crisis that would tend to push, maybe not completely enough, society towards an evaluation of its foundation.
Well, I mean, that's what Marxist hoped, right?
Right.
So to make that a little simpler, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that came up for me when you were bringing this up. I happen to have been, for completely something separate, studying the business cycle debates when the German historical school people of the last generation of the German historical school came up with their answers. And so that's like Weber, Werner Sombart, Baron Tubanovsky, who is not German, he's Russian. But what's interesting about these guys is they're all, they have some relationship to Marxism. Werner Sombart was praised by Engels. Baron Tubanovsky was originally part of, the Mensheviks, the Russian Social Democrats before the split. He actually defects to the Narodniks before the Bolshevik-Menshevik split even happens. And so there's a backdoor argument here that Lukács is trying to settle. And I have to remind people, this is in 1924. So, like, we think about things like post-1928, 1930, but he is trying to settle some stuff with in debates in Marxism in the second and early third internationals right now, and with the defectors. So bring up Baron Tarnowski's like, oh, he's bringing up a defector, and what he's saying is like, one of the reasons why this guy leaves Marxism is because he has to remove production and sensuous life entirely, and he comes up with the business cycle theory, the primary one that like gets picked up by the late Austrian school through Joseph Schumpeter, which is the overinvestment theory. And the reason why I think such a big deal is being made out of that is Lukasz is pointing out that, like, well, if you believe what Baron Tarnowski believes, there actually is a way to mitigate against the business cycle and thus to at least lessen or reduce crisis, and that's state intervention in investment. But what Lukasz is pointing out is like the quantification of, as you said, anything, like, is going to lead to problems down the way. So like you talk about, if you're a yarn producer, you adjust your intakes and outtakes. Eventually you're still going to have a problem because the quantification of a lack of profits on, say, sweaters, because you produce too many and they've saturated the economy and you haven't figured out planned obsolescence, or there's a limit to planned obsolescence. And so far there is. Eventually downstream, they're going to quit buying your yarn. And so you're going to have a quantitative problem too. And that's going to create further and further fractures. Right. And if you really believe that, there's no way to be a capitalist and not have a business cycle. Like, maybe you can mitigate against the business cycle through liquidity schemes, a la modern monetary theory or Keynesianism. Maybe you can mitigate against it through investment regulations. That's Baron Tarnowski. That's most Democrats now today. But all you're doing is mitigating. The primary problem, which is created by the commodity fetish itself, is never going to go away. Like, you might find a temporary fix, but it eventually is going to stop working because things are going to get caught up, and you're going to have a new temporary fix. You know, this is what, you know, this is Henrik Grossman's big deal about like counter tendencies. Yeah, the counter tendencies are accidental or deliberate temporary fixes to the problem, but they're temporary. Okay, so I think that's interesting, and I think that's interesting too, because on the standpoint of thought, which is what Lukacs is concerned with, it means that like, this is doing something to your thinking where you like, you see this phone as an object. You don't see this phone as both the product of, and maybe a little bit participating in social reproduction, because the nature of social media makes it a little bit more obvious, but you don't really see this as like something that comes from and continues to contribute to social reproduction. Right. And the reason why you don't do that is because, like, you don't, it's like, no, this is so specialized and takes so many different things to make that, like, nobody actually has a full understanding of how all elements of it work, probably. All right. At least in their head at the same time. And so the only way you can approach that, not as a process of something you build, which has use, but you also understand its sensuous process, how it was built, what came up, because even if you participated in building it, the product was removed from you and you only know, like, I don't know, the transistors or the screen, or maybe you're a repair person and you know how to repair stuff, but you don't really know how it was put together. Or maybe you were part of the lithium mine, but you don't, at no point of the social production cycle do you actually experience everything that goes into this. And thus, you don't, when you approach this, you don't see this as coming from those relationships at all. And that leads to, you know, the subject-object split, which is an alienation problem that you know, Lukacs is going to recognize from Hegel. It's kind of always there, but now it's hard, right? It's no longer just like, I'm not just alienated from other people because of because, you know, I experience myself as a subject who hits another subject, but has to treat that subject as an object of which I encounter. Right. Mm-hmm. Now it's like everything I do reinforces that alienation.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no real way out of it. Like, so your example of the business cycle and the tendency of the rate of profits to fall, which, you know, I find interesting because, you know, we don't have a lot of things in Marxism that, like, we can pat ourselves on the back and say we empirically predict this consistently. Mm-hmm. We empirically predict this consistently, and most people's responses to it is to either change the meaning of profits,
mm-hmm.
To talk about the problems in the way we measure profits, like GDP is a problem. Yeah, it is problematic, but it is, you know, it does tell something. Or to pretend that, like, profits don't really exist, that you just have, like, income valorization or something. And Lukacs would say, yeah, that makes sense that people would do that because they don't want to deal with the fact that there's that this alienation is something we're going to push against, but, and it is an illusion, but it's a necessary illusion to function. Like, we can't say comprehend all this at once, even. And the easiest way to comprehend it in a way that you can rationally comprehend it is in this instrumental and numerical rationality sense. Like, oh, I at least know the value of this, you know, $70 or something, $800 when I buy it, you know, whatever. Like, I can understand that.
I was gonna say, you got that phone for $70? Where'd you get that? I want one of those. All right. So the other part of the other thing that occurred to me while I was reading this is that on the one hand, reification is a very big problem for people who want to create change and overcome, let's say, the inequities and the injustices and the alienation involved in our current society. For people who want to be subjects in society rather than objects themselves pushed around, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, that reification and alienation both makes it possible to accomplish technical tasks that we would never have been able to accomplish in any other way historically, that we by
one person can mass produce these, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah, no, you really hardly can mass produce anything as one person, actually.
Right.
And no one person could even produce one of those, you know, let alone mass produce them. Right.
Right. I mean, this is a product of why we like to reify this as a product of Steve Jobs or whatever. It's actually a product of, like, fuck, it's a product of many different bourgeois societies, even. Like,
right.
it's a coalition of dead labor. Like, it's that you don't experience as dead labor. And by that, I mean, like, people have built stuff that enabled us to build stuff. And, like, they may be long dead, but we're using, like, the early cybernetics theorists in the Soviet Union or in the 1950s United States that we're using, you know, as inputs into this thing, which they also could not have foreseen or done. Yeah. I mean, there is a real sense of technical progress here. And I guess one thing you can say about that is often thrown at Lager to Frankfurt School, and I'm not sure that they're guilty of it.
I don't think they are. If you're about to say what I think you're about to say, but keep going. Yeah.
I'm not sure if they're guilty of it, but, you know, oh God, 13 years ago or so, you interviewed John Saracen, who took this idea and, like, went with it to this totally, we need to get rid of all technology because technology is a form of reification. But, you know, ideally, we get rid of human thought, too, because human thought's based off of a separation of self and
John
other.
John Saracen,
yeah.
Yeah.
We did. It was actually, like, the third episode of the OG Series 1 pre-Zero Books pre-Sublation Media Pop the Left. Like,
right.
But so I can see how people can misunderstand this concept and run with it in very weird ways. there's also the, you know, the accusation. And again, I'm not sure that all of the Frankfurt School is guilty of it. I do know that it is a reading of the Frankfurt School that says that, you know, limiting this to saying this reification is endemic to all of bourgeois society. If you take it to its logical conclusion and add stuff like concepts like real subsumption into it, you can start saying, well, you know, the proletariat itself is a product of bourgeois society, and you can also not get past this form of reification. So there is no way out, or the only way out is it's automatic collapse. Or if you're more optimistic, you can go, you know, Edward Bernstein read it and go like, well, there is a way out, but it's through the development of these technical procedures, which is going to lead to more and more democratization, and that will lead to more and more accumulation of workers' power through parliamentary republics, and then we'll just get socialism through a natural chain of events. Mm-hmm. That's where, you know, like what Lenin calls economism comes from. Mm-hmm. All these things are what, you know, you could take, if you take this bourgeois society thinking, and look, Bernstein had not read Lukács. Bernstein is working on that 20, 30 years before this essay is written. But like,
right. Mm-hmm.
you can kind of see in this essay actually where this line of thinking could also go wrong. And maybe we had already seen it by the time Lukács is writing this essay. And I think that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons why I find this essay so much more important. I also, just as a side note, I actually find this at odds with the Marxist methodology essay at the end of History and Class Consciousness, because I'm like, yeah, but reification is part of Marxist method, and like, you actually explain it really well, and then I don't know, at the end of this book you seem to throw it out. I know that Chris Catron's going to tell me that's a vulgar reading, but because I know.
Well, maybe we can go back. We should go back to it maybe in the months to come. But right. So
where did you have problems with this essay?
Well, that was one of them, the Helferding quote. And my concern that there was a possible justification. I mean, he definitely tries to avoid it, but the a way to read this text is saying, well, what we need to do is understand the real qualitative natural processes that are being performed through this form of capitalism. And if we start there, then we can develop an alternative to capitalism based on understanding coming out of the natural sciences. Or we can, if we take up what we need to do is return to understanding the natural world.
So basically you could misread this to as return to monkey.
You could read it that way, or you could read it, you know, understand more of nature so we can get it aligned with it, and maybe remain in some way technological. But we need to improve. You could read it as saying we need to improve the instruments of production along qualitative lines. Rather than in terms of their quantitative aspects, which are really just based on an abstract.
So we should jettison math.
Like, yeah. Well, no, we don't have to jettison math, because in fact, you're going to be right back at the quantitative when you start. When you go into the natural sciences, you're right back into the quantitative immediately.
You have to.
So it really isn't any solution, but it could be read that way. It's like, oh, if we could only think about things in terms of the qualitative. I worried that there might be a reading like that, and I've been talking to someone on the Discord who is a physicist who and a Keynesian, I think, of some kind, and who's just pointing to post-Marxism and the need for understanding capitalism as a natural system, or a perversion of a natural system, or something along those lines, and I rail against it, and saying You're reifying. You know, that's not right.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing is like, this is, we haven't mentioned this, but we experience reification as natural.
Right.
Like, we talk about this as an object as if it's natural to talk about it as an object because we've assigned it a category and an identity, etc. This is what Lukash and Negative Dialectics is like going on about, like, identity is the or form of ideology, which people think means identity politics, and it doesn't. It means like, right. It means like, yeah. Conceptually naming things and objectifying them through a name hides their process.
Right.
And that in of itself is an ideological move.
Right. But ideology is not only negative.
No, it's not. Right. I mean, like, right. Like, you're not going to, like, in the sense of, like, total de-alienation, right? I don't think Marx, one of the biggest criticisms I hear from, like, post-Keynesians and MMTers and stuff about Marx is that that Marx's theory of alienation makes Marxism lapsarian. So, like, that we have to, like, we have to go back to a de-alienated past. And I'm like, I don't get that at all from later Marx. Mm-hmm. And I also don't think this whole, like, hard split between early and later Marx is valid. Like, there are splits, but there's, like, mini splits or developments in thought and minor changes. Mm-hmm. But that's why I always point out, like, okay, alienation, reification, commodity fetish, and I, like I said, Lukash, like, starts with the latter to get to the particular capitalist form or the former, but part of that's also because alienation is universal to the human subject. Like, like, dealing with alienation in Hegel, and Lukash seems to accept this, is, like, what drives human subject formation in the first place. At least in the Hegel answer to the Kant problem. And I mean, and it's in these essays where, like, Lukash says, like, basically Hegel's right, but Hegel mystifies the solution, like, in the whole, like, world spirit things where we need to actually look at the material production of the world, a la Marx, and then we can start getting to how to undo this, which leads to the thing that you, like, you can take that and lead it to the thing that you were saying, like, oh, we just study more natural sciences and we can overcome the metabolic process of capital. He uses those words, like, the metabolic process of capital. We could somehow shift it back to a more natural metabolic process. And I think in Marx, as a dialectician, Marx would say we don't even really want to go back to primitive communism. Like, right. Yes, primitive communism is, like, gives us a model that says that, yeah, we can, like, humans are not inherently hierarchical or whatever, but we don't really want to go back to primitive communism, because what enabled primitive communism was absolute impoverishment. Like, even from anthropological studies, like, relatively egalitarian societies don't have a surplus. Rarely have a surplus, right? Like, this is something David Graeber both admits and mystifies simultaneously in a lot of his books. So Marx is like, yeah, I mean, and this is, like, almost a vulgar dialectical move. It's like, if we have enough abundance through this process of commodification, then we could actually reproduce the benefits of this primitive form of, you know, of classless society. I'm always hesitant to use egalitarian, but of classless society without, you know, the fucking poverty. But I mean, that does get, that's the kind of thing that, like, I think that's why, you know, this is my argument with our friend and comrade Ben Burgess, because I'm like, once you drop the dialectical element of this, I don't know what you base the movement of these modes of production on, right? Now, I want to say, there are days where I'm not always convinced of this. Like, I'm not always convinced this holds, but I think we do have to understand the logic of what Marx is dealing with, and then why Lukash is trying to apply it in a way that, like, he's trying to plan a way that answers both the philosophical and political economic problems of his day by saying, like, look, we can't, like, you're not going to find, like a technical or abstract or instrumental or one element of bourgeois society that you can use to undo all of this. There's, like, that's not possible. The only way to undo it is, you know, the subject object, which is the, which is found in the class, which has the least invested in it.
And also is the most directly responsible for its reproduction.
Right. Right. And, yeah. And they actually do the shit that makes the stuff. Like,
yeah. Right.
And like, so they could theoretically continue doing making the stuff, but since they have no investment in this current society through their propertylessness, they actually have a reason to forego bourgeois society where no one else does.
Right.
That's the logic. And what's interesting is he's trying to use that logic to settle stuff. He's trying to use that logic to settle aesthetic questions, sociological questions, and philosophical questions at the same time. That's what like that's what that last paragraph is about, right? I'll just read it.
Yeah, read it.
All right. Or the last
Thus, philosophy stands in the same relation to the special sciences as they do with respect to empirical reality.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Should I read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
The formalistic conceptualization of the special sciences become for philosophy an immutably given substratum, and this signals the final and despairing renunciation of every attempt to cast light on the reification that lies at the root of this formalism. The reified world appears henceforth quite definitively and in philosophy under the spotlight of criticism. It is potentiated still further as the only possible world, the only conceptually accessible, comprehensible world vouchsafed to us humans. Whether this gives rise to ecstasy, resignation, or despair, whether we search for a path leading to life via irrational mystical experience, this will do absolutely nothing to modify the situation as it is in fact. By confining itself to the study of the possible conditions of the validity of the forms in which its underlying existence is manifested, modern bourgeois thought bars its own way to a clear view of the problems bearing on the birth and death of these forms and on their real essence and substratum. It finds precipicity, its precipicity finds itself increasingly in the situation of that legendary critic in India. He was confronted with the ancient story according to which the world rests upon an elephant. He unleashed the critical question, upon what does the elephant rest? On receiving the answer that the elephant stands on a tortoise, criticism declared itself satisfied. It is obvious that even if he had continued to press apparently critical questions, he could only have elicited a third miraculous animal. He would not have been able to discover the solution to the real question.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, because even in the history of, say, Western thought, all right, you around the beginning of capitalism, you have a split between what was traditionally called natural philosophy, a la going back to Aristotle. And yes, there's all kinds of errors in Aristotle. We don't have to get to that right now before people bring it up. Mm-hmm. But the splitting of natural philosophy into philosophy as a place where you think about the mode of possibilities and sciences where you actually do them and never the twain shall meet. And if anyone's ever dealt with philosophy of science, you know how never the twain shall meet is. Mm-hmm. This is a huge problem. And you can actually see what he's talking about because, okay, now we figure out we have to separate is and oughts. We have to separate norms and descriptors. We have to separate all that. And because we have to separate it all, we can never understand society as a whole. And because of that, all philosophy can do is like give us fights of Flancy and we might be able to like, you know, he's kind of subtly criticizing Hegel here. Like we can revel in the world spirit, but like, it's not going to change anything at all. Mm-hmm. The only way, you know, to get out of this is to change the way you reproduce the world, and that's changing the totality. But honestly, in this essay, he doesn't go there. That he goes there in other essays in this book, but this is not the essay which he does it. So if like you were just to end on this essay, you're like, well, how the hell do you get out of this problem?
Right, I know. Well, listen, we've been talking for about 55 minutes, and what I want to do now is talk about the current political moment. I'm not going to give you another. Well, why don't why don't I send you another link in just a moment, and we'll do the second thing. But what we'll pick up here is how reification is acting upon us in this current moment, and the intensification maybe of reification right now.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.